This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is an edited recording of the panel discussion that was held at the BFM Health and Living Junior event on November 13th. BFM Health and Living Junior is presented by Nippon Paint, the coating expert.
Good morning, and we're back. So we're going to be talking about, are we overreacting as far as our kids are concerned? I know I was a paranoid mother when I had my children, and these topics really resonate with me. And what more when you have such solid answers coming from, you know, people who are in the know. So we have on stage today to help us understand whether we're overreacting or not, Dr. Yong Junina Fadzil. She's a consultant pediatrician and pediatric cardiologist from Clinic Pakar Kanak-Kanak Junina. Welcome, Dr. Junina. Thank you for coming. Also with us, Dr. Chiang Hon Kit, all the way from Penang. He's a consultant pediatrician and neonatologist, Hospital Lam Wah Ee in Penang. Welcome and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay, so start with a simple question. Do you think we're overreacting, Dr. Chiang? Do you think we're overreacting when it comes to our children?
I think yes and no. To some extent, our understanding of diseases are very much affected by what we hear, what we see. And like you mentioned earlier, the social media, the Facebook, the WhatsApp, every day you see news that is frightening. But that doesn't mean that those are very common, just that because the access to information is faster. So to some extent, create some anxiety and some fear among parents. Mm-hmm. That's yes, we are overreacting. But no, because to some extent, children, they are vulnerable. Like what the little girl says, we are vulnerable to infections, viruses, bacteria is all over the place. And to some extent, some cases can be very sick. So if you don't look after and don't handle the case properly, then you may end up with some very bad consequences.
Dr. Yong, you know, I've asked her this question before, I know. We live in a safer environment, we know so much more, but still we're so paranoid. Why is that?
I think it depends on who's defining paranoia and over-parenting and overreacting. Certainly, I think we're more responsive because of our enhanced knowledge and because we can now access knowledge more easily and readily. And I think because we also survived our childhood, we know what we got up to as children. I know I nearly cycled myself into a well, but I make sure that my kids don't ever do that. And sometimes we go to the extent that we totally mollycoddle them, we totally wrap them in bubble wrap, just so that they don't get injured. Maybe we ourselves were injured, or we got very sick when we were young, or we know of relatives whose children were sick. And what we're trying to do is actually to protect our own children from getting sick, or we're trying to protect ourselves from losing our children. The key thing is to know how much is adequate and how much is excessive.
I think the underlying factor is fear, don't you think?
I think it's fear and concern.
Yeah. Okay. What are some of the common mistakes that we make? I think a simple thing like how we administer fever medication, sometimes we don't get it right, Dr. Chiang. Do you find that a problem? And then you read about how a child dies because of an overdose of paracetamol, for an example, and then you get all, you know, what am I doing wrong?
Like I said earlier, we should not take fever lightly. But on the other hand, we should not be over sort of excited when the child is having fever. Say for example, we know that every children, they will have at least 5-6 infections in a year. That is expected, some mild respiratory tract infection, some coughing colds. So we should not overreact to taking
paracetamol.
Okay. Just by a mild viral infection.
Some of our children are seeing the pediatrician every other week. Is that normal, Dr. Yong?
Depends on why they're seeing the pediatrician. Mm-hmm. If a child is not well and requires follow-up, then yes, it is acceptable that the child comes back to see the same pediatrician 2 weeks later. But I think it's also important that when the child does see a pediatrician, the parents and the pediatrician communicate so that parents know what to expect and not worry unnecessarily. A lot of times, parents will worry if the child's, say, chickenpox is not better after 5 days, because the pediatrician has not informed the parents that it is expected to take about a week or so to clear up. Or if the child has slight sniffles, for example, we've got to tell the parents what to expect, when to worry, and what are the worry signs and what are the danger signs to look out for. Because On the one hand, you have parents who worry incessantly and come at every single sniffle. On the other, you also have parents who don't want to trouble their pediatricians and feel that everything is under control, only to turn up at the hospital when the child's condition has worsened, and the child may have high fever and pneumonia.
Okay. And
can I add something to the paracetamol thing you mentioned? There are new evidence showing that paracetamol, to some extent, increases the risk of asthma.
Asthma?
Yes. So there's a trend now that we should move away from overdosing children with paracetamol and only to give it when the fever is really high and there's some discomfort, say, for example, pain in the throat, pain in the ear. So we should not overdosing our children.
But if we overdose them, they wouldn't have an asthma attack. They wouldn't live to have an asthma attack.
These are still very new evidence.
So what do you mean by excessive usage of paracetamol then? Because you were told 4 times a day, am I correct?
Yes.
4 times a day?
Yes, every 6 hours.
Every 6 hours? Okay, so that is okay?
Yes, but on the other hand, if the fever is mild and the child is still, despite the fever, still running around happily, you know, active, so there's no great concern to control the temperature by itself.
Okay, so my pediatrician used to say 38 degrees, it's okay, it's the body's way of coping. That's quite a normal thing for a child to have fever because it's a sign that they're actually fighting something. But some kids are running around with 39 degrees and 39.5. So how then do you make that distinction?
Well, some kids are running around at 39. Some kids develop febrile fits at 38.5. So I don't think you can apply a blanket rule. I think to each child is an individual and should be treated as such. And if the parents are concerned, I think we have to address that concern and see why the child is having a fever and then advise accordingly.
Okay. Common accidents. What would you say are common accidents amongst children, Dr. Chow?
Falls.
Falls, yes.
Being hit by the elder sibling.
Well, falls, I mean, it's quite normal, isn't it? Falling down.
Very common.
And, you know, later if you listen to Dr. Rajini in The Importance of Play, she will say it's a good thing to fall because then the kid can actually gauge the distance between where they are and the floor, and that's a way of how a child develops. Yes. So what fall are you referring to?
If the fall resulting in serious injuries, say, for example, there are big bumps on the head.
Yeah, from a height.
From certain heights. Unusual pain on the body parts, for example, he may have a broken bone somewhere. So if a common fall, just a trip over, as they're running, and within that first 24 hours, there are no major signs, for example, no vomiting, the child is still active, alert, then there's no major concern about the simple falls.
What else, Dr. Janina?
Scrapes, cuts, playground accident, you know, you trip on a little stone,
it's okay.
Cut your knee a bit. I think that's okay,
yes.
But it's important to clean the wound, and then the child knows the consequence of not looking where they're running. The child may trip again. If there are broken bones, and of course they have to be taken to hospital. If the child looks ill, but most importantly, if the parents are worried about a change in behavior in the child, then yes, they ought to seek some medical attention.
Okay.
As I said, elder siblings can hit the younger sibling. I've had cases where an elder sibling stepped on the tummy of a baby because the child was lying on the floor, the baby was lying on the floor. This do happen, so parents have to make sure that the babies are safe in their cots.
Okay, there's so much pressure on us as parents. I mean, how much do you really monitor? How much, you can't be all over the place at the same time. So how do we monitor? And then when something happens, the first thing is you are blamed for being negligent or not, for not keeping an eye on them.
We can only do our best. So the first thing you can do is to minimize the risk of accidents or injuries. Accidents are non-preventable, they are accidents, but we can minimize the risk of injuries by child-proofing our homes to a certain extent. For example, not polishing the staircase so the child wouldn't slip coming down the stairs, not putting a rug at the top of the stairs, again, to avoid slipping, to avoid furniture with sharp edges or glass tables when you have a young child, to put safety gates at front doors, at the doorway leading to the kitchen. If you have a swimming pool, to put a fence around the swimming pool, to put gates in front of bathrooms so that they don't go in, play with water and drown in a pail of water, especially with these recent water cuts that we're having. A lot of parents are keeping water in pails, bathtubs and everything. So it's important that these kids do not get into the bathroom, because if they can't get to that water, they won't drown. So we can prevent this accident from happening to a certain extent. As for vigilance, we're not supposed to leave young children on their own in the home. If you've got, you're cooking in the kitchen, then it's, you've got to make sure that there's a gate or something, because you've got to keep an eye on them while cooking. And simple things like electrical cords should not be left dangling off the surfaces so that a child will not pull on it. Avoid using things like big tablecloths when you have a big jug of hot tea, for example, on the table, so the child won't pull on the tablecloth and result in the kettle or the jug falling over them and scalding them.
Which brings me to burns. I think burns are also quite a common accident, Dr. Chang.
I fully agree. My own daughter, due to my own ignorance, had a burn on her feet because of the hot milk I was preparing. Hot water I was preparing to prepare the milk, and accidentally spilled, and result of that, she has quite a bad burn on her feet. So burn is a very common, I fully agree. So you should not have any hot beverages, hot soups nearby to children. Make sure their temperature is just warm enough to be consumed by them. Fully agree with all the cables, wires, to the kettle, to the pots. So those are potential harms.
What do you do when a child has a burn immediately?
First aid, cool down the temperature.
How?
By running water.
Running water?
Yeah, cool running.
Not Colgate. Water. My mom always said put Colgate on it.
No Colgate, no boy cream.
Yeah. Running water, okay.
Cool running water. Keep the wound clean. If the area of the wound is big enough, then you need to be treated at the hospital. There are a lot of serious consequences if the burn is bad.
Burns, Dr. Yong?
I agree with him.
Okay, all right. What about poisoning?
Definitely. I think one of the most common accidents I see in my practice is children accidentally mistaken tablets as MMMs. So, you know, our medication by adults, they come in strips sometimes, or loose tablets. They think they are sweets. So very common, they accidentally swallow medicine from the adults. So very important to keep medicine away from children, have childproof caps of syrups. The best is keep in high cupboards where there's no access.
Okay.
To the children.
Medication now compared to our time is tastes a lot nicer. It's quite yummy, actually, I have to say. And sometimes the children want more, and we keep a lot of this stuff in the fridge, and that's not very high. So that's another hazard to a large extent.
That's the importance of the childproof lock on the covers, as well as to keep it as far deep in the fridge, you know, to the back of the fridge, and hopefully your child can't reach it, or to apply, to use one of those fridge locks that you can actually buy from baby shops, so that they can't open the door, the fridge door. Because opening the fridge door in itself is a risk. There's so many things. Even if it doesn't cause harm to them, they can actually start emptying the fridge by taking stuff out and throwing them to the ground, resulting in us, parents, having to clean up after them.
Okay. If you know they have consumed medication from the fridge in large quantities, what do we do?
Take them to the hospital. Don't try to self-medicate.
And tell the what do we tell the doctor?
Bring the bottle if you can. Take the bottle that you suspect your child has taken. Take it along with you. Go to the emergency department. Show it to the doctor and say, I think my child drank half a bottle of this.
What will you do?
I would not keep my medication within the reach of my children.
But what can you do in the event that a child has actually consumed?
It depends on which medication the child has taken. If it's multivites, it is not likely that it was going to cause any problems, because our multivites today don't contain iron. A lot of them are just water-soluble vitamins. But for example, if they were to have taken salbutamol, which is used for asthma, then they're going to get a lot of tremors because of the overdose. And their potassium levels can drop, because that is one of the side effects of salbutamol. So you have to take them in to be monitored. If they have taken a bottle of paracetamol because it's yummy, whether it's orange or strawberry flavored, then they have to be brought in, because we've got to check their levels, because that can affect their internal organs.
So what can you do?
Parents or doctors?
Doctors.
Depending on the severity, they can either do a stomach washout, like gastric lavage. They put in a tube and they try to remove as much as possible. With paracetamol, they can actually give an antidote. With salbutamol, they will monitor the patient's heart rate. They will monitor the child's potassium levels and see whether they need to replace it or not.
Okay, so there are ways in which you can reverse the whole poisoning thing.
One of the common mistakes a lot of parents, especially old people, used to induce vomiting if they suspect the child accidentally ingested something.
Yep.
That is very wrong. Okay, because potential harm is when you induce vomiting by digging the throat. It's good if it's vomit, but what happens if it aspirates into the lungs? So it's quite dangerous to do that. So what Dr. Yong says is absolutely true. If necessary, we do a stomach washout in a controlled sort of.
Okay. Even seizures, back in the day, they would say, stick a spoon in the mouth. Nuh-uh.
No.
Not the way.
No.
Why? So what should you do if a child is having a seizure?
Most seizures happens when a child having fever will stop most of them within 5 minutes. So if you can keep your calm,
What do you do while the child is having a fit?
What you do is keep your calm. You must stay very calm.
Try.
Lie the child down, put the child to the side, so that in case the child has a lot of saliva and aspirate himself, so that is allow the saliva to come out. And don't try to put anything at all into the mouth. I've seen cases coming in with broken teeth, torn lips, and so on.
Because?
Because of what we're trying to force something into their mouth.
Okay.
And we have seen a lot of injured fingers because of the heroic
act. They stick the finger.
Yeah, that is again, it's a wrong...
Heroes la.
Yeah, those are heroes.
Want to save lives. Yeah. No, but then you don't blame us. That's what we know from what was done before, right? Yeah. When it comes to seizures, it is okay if they bite their tongue.
They're unlikely to bite their tongue because the tongue tends to fall back.
If you put them on the side?
Even at the time of the seizure, a lot of parents will report the eyes rolling
back
and then the head tilting back. The tongue will fall back. That's why you put them on the side so that they don't choke on their saliva. Okay, and then you loosen their clothing. You put them somewhere free from furniture so that if they're having a seizure, they don't injure themselves by continuously hitting against the furniture. If they're having a fever, bring down the fever by putting wet cloth on them, just getting them, doing tepid sponging.
Yep.
Okay, and bringing down the fever.
Bring down the fever. Sometimes the easiest thing to do is to throw the child in the bathroom and just...
Not while they're fitting, though.
No, not while you're fitting, no. But when you know it's high and the paracetamol isn't really working, the best thing to do is to throw them in and bring down the temperature with cold water?
Under the tap,
yeah.
Lukewarm water.
Okay. It's always a difficult thing for a mother to do because you have a screaming child.
Yes.
And then you sort of pull back. You don't want to do it. But ideally, that is the best thing to do.
Actually, it is more pleasant for the child if she is under the shower. She's in the bathroom. You turn on the shower, lukewarm water, put some toys there and play with her. Or you run a bubble bath. Rather than putting water.
At 3 a.m. in the morning, Dr. Yong. Have fun with them. Put the toys on the floor.
Just don't use ice, which is what they used to do in the 70s.
Yes. So no ice.
No ice.
And no wrapping them up, hoping that they would sweat either.
No.
Because that will increase the temperature and before it drops. Okay. Let's move on to feeding difficulties. I think a lot of us have problems feeding our children. Malaysians are famous. Everywhere you go, you will see parents running around with the, you know, bowl and the spoon trying to feed the child. Up to 45 minutes, I remember doing it, guilty as can be. Not the way, really.
No.
But our children need to eat, Dr. Yong.
Yes, but they also need to learn that there is a time and place for eating, and we can make that place more enjoyable for them, so there is no need to chase after them. I think some children are put off eating because when they sit at the dining table, what's your grade? What did you do in school? How come you got only 78% for your maths today? So the dinner time becomes a nagging session. And it's like interrogation from the parents to the child about schoolwork, school results and school exams.
But that has changed. Now we put them in front of the iPad and then the food just goes in without, they don't even know what they're eating anymore.
Yes, that's just feeding them. They're not enjoying the taste.
Are they supposed to?
They're not enjoying eating. Yes, you're supposed to enjoy what you eat. You're supposed to savor every mouthful. Only then
really?
Will you appreciate.
Can we ask the kids here whether they even care? But picky eaters is a big problem, Dr. Chiang.
Definitely, because I think our social context is changed. The way of living is changed. Both parents are working. So now the taking care of the child is left to either the grandparents, if they are lucky, they have grandparents. Yeah, but not so lucky, not so fortunate, you're probably at the daycare center or kakak or auntie. So the eating habits is very much affected by how the child is being fed from young. So if they don't have a good modeling, they don't know how is a proper eating. Because nowadays, to make sure the child finish the food, you carry the bowl all over the place instead of sitting on the table to eat. So that's how they grow up knowing that that is eating. So modeling is very important. And what we feed and how we feed and when we feed is also equally important.
Okay, but then I always say, I don't know an adult who doesn't eat. They will eat anyway. So why stress?
I actually don't eat if I don't like the food.
Really. The reason I'm telling you this is because my eldest didn't eat till she was 3 and a half. She lived on milk and cereal. And there just came a point when I said, enough is enough. I'm not going to stress for 45 minutes to an hour trying to feed this child. And people would come and say, my goodness, so thin, la. How can you, why are you not feeding her, la? She doesn't want to eat. Then I told myself, adults, as an adult, she will eat anyway. So at 4, she decided to slowly start eating. And she eats today. So should I worry that she didn't eat till 3 and a half?
To some extent, yes.
Oh,
because
no.
If
it's
their
a bit
diet,
late now.
Normally, if a parent comes to see me, I'll get some history. To what extent the child is not eating? The most common pattern of so-called poor eating is the parent's misperception that the child is not eating. The parent think the child is not eating, but actually they're eating non-stop 24 hours. Otherwise, they wouldn't be alive until now. So that's a perception issue. And of course, we have to look at the child. When you mentioned the child is scrawny and thin, is it a nutritional issue? So if to the extent the growth is affected, then we have to look deep into what is the problem behind.
Do parents come and see you?
Yes.
When the children are not eating?
Yes, they do.
They do.
They do come to discuss feeding issues with me, feeding difficulties, children being picky eaters. And actually, we do sit down. I take the measurements of the child to see if the child is indeed not growing or if the child is growing adequately. Because sometimes parents are pressured into conforming to societal norms or familial norms. When somebody keeps telling them, or their family members keep telling them that the child is scrawny, you'd be surprised. The scrawny term is used for children ranging from really skinny kids to chubby kids. But because the grandparents or aunties or friends or relatives keep harping on the issue that this child is scrawny,
I mean, face it, la, our Asian people, yeah. You have to be chubby, otherwise something is seriously wrong.
Chubby is cute.
Yes.
That's a misconception.
That is a misconception.
But if the child truly is not eating, then I would look in detail as to what the child takes on a daily basis. As Dr. Chiang says, they can't be starving. A lot of times you find that the child takes a lot of milk. So over the age of 1, they don't need to take milk every 3 hours. They just need to take about 3 glasses a day. But all too often, when the child refuses to eat, they are then given a bottle of milk.
Yep.
And what do you do with the bottle of milk? You lie down in front of the TV, and then you drink. Now, if I were a child, given a choice between sitting at the table and sitting in front of my favorite TV program, I would choose the latter. So I can then manipulate my caregivers into not wanting to eat and then allowing them to give me milk. So I'm getting the nutrition, I'm getting the calories, but I'm not learning how to eat as I should. Because the whole thing about eating is not just getting nutrition in, but growing up. Because as an adult, you don't want to be my age and still carrying a glass of milk and taking it every 3 hours.
No, that will never happen.
If you don't train them to chew. Yes.
I think sometimes it's a chewing problem. Some children hate the texture and so they don't really want to chew.
I have a 10-year-old that I see with special needs who still doesn't eat. But because it's special needs, so we actually have some leeway and we go on a slower pace, is it, with that. But it is also about children, normal children, we have to actually awaken their natural curiosity into wanting to taste new food and texture. And that's where the issue of overparenting comes back into play. If we control them too much, then we curb this natural innate curiosity that they're born with. And that may result in them not wanting to try new food.
Okay, Dr. Chiang.
Talking about chewing.
Yep.
It's recommended that a child should start to be weaned off milk and introduce supplementary food at 6 months. So if this weaning process is delayed, say for example the child has only started solids way delayed after 9 months, after 1 year, then the chewing, the learning to swallow will be delayed as well. So it's very important that the child is weaned on to supplementary food at the right time so that the swallowing and chewing development is there.
Is it a bad thing to be underweight?
Depends on how underweight the child is, because there is a range.
Yeah.
And today, for children under the age of 2, we use a weight versus height chart as opposed to discrete weight and height chart so that we see they're growing adequately.
When is intervention required if you think your child is underweight?
there's a difference between small size and underweight. So like what Dr. Yong say, to us as doctors, we look at the growth, whether the child is growing according to what the child's supposed to be for her height and for her genetic predisposition. If a mother is small size, father is small size, you don't expect a child to be big and stout.
Yep.
So if the child is not growing according to the rate that the child's supposed to be, then we are concerned.
Okay. So you can predict the height of a child?
Yes. More or less.
Oh. And they're doing it outside in one of the booths, actually, if you want to find out. But genes play a big role. That's beyond your control.
Yes. We are not talking about height per se. Like, you're looking at weight. Because of those growth charts that you all see in the doctor's clinic, it's supposed to be plotted every time the child comes to the clinic. And what we ought to see is a child growing along his line, along a particular centile. So if a child is, say, at the 50th centile, that means 50% of children his or her age are at that weight, at that particular age. And supposing the child were to drop to the 10th centile, suddenly, then it's crossing two centile lines. That is a cause for concern. We have to find out why this child is not gaining weight. The child may be gaining weight. The child may have gained 1 kilo in 3 months, but he's dropped across the centile chart because he's supposed to be gaining more than that. That is more important than the actual gaining or losing of weight. No child should be losing weight. Every child should be gaining, but how much the child gains is what's important, and that's what we plot on the centile chart. So we want to see the rate of growth, and we want to see that the child maintains a steady rate of growth as per the centile chart, which is appropriate for his or her age.
Can you catch up on lost growth?
Yes.
How?
Adequate nutrition, patient parents.
Patient parents.
If the child is not well, if the child has not been well for a period of time, it is expected that the child will not gain weight during this time. For example, heart failure, poorly controlled asthma. But once we get the condition under control, then we expect to see the weight picking up. Okay? As long as the weight picks up and follows a centile line, it may not be the initial centile line initially, it may be at the lower level, but as long as he then follows that line, then it is not so worrying, because we now have identified why he wasn't growing, and we have rectified that issue, and the child is now growing again.
Okay, which is a good thing. Any questions from the floor?
There's one.
Yep, go ahead.
This is for Dr. Yong. Have you ever seen a case where a mother doing a breastfeeding exclusive to a baby up to 2 years old? Because I do have my niece. She doesn't want to feed her baby up to 2 years old. So were there any good benefit out of it? This is all about sunnah.
Okay. So your question is, when do you stop, is it?
No, the question is whether it brings any benefits or whether it is harmful to just give breast milk to the baby. Okay, when you say exclusive breastfeeding, normally what we mean is they don't give formula. But by 6 months, at 6 months of age, we should start introducing solids to the child. Because after 1 year of age especially, breast milk alone without any additional source of nutrition is no longer adequate to sustain a child's growth.
Any other question?
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a 10-month-old daughter. She refused to drink wire bottles. She just want to latch. So how do I stop latching and then start to give her bottle?
Okay.
Actually, you're doing a very good job. In terms of our definition, you're successfully breastfeeding your baby. And we will not encourage you to actually stop breastfeeding, because breast milk is still the best way, and it's still the best source of nutrition for your baby in addition to solid food. Why? By starting solids at 6 months, it doesn't mean that you stop your breast milk. You continue your breastfeeding. However, if you need to go out and you want to give breast milk in a bottle in your absence, normally if the mother is not around, the child will take to a certain... No? She's got a stronger will than that.
Persevere, or you'll have no social life. I can understand what that feels like. Any other question?
Just going back to one of the questions that Veera had asked earlier when we started the program, and both doctors, I think, favoured the lavage, is it? When a child consumes...
Well, one of the options
drugs,
is gastric
yeah.
lavage in a hospital setting
yeah.
with
but
the airway protector.
Okay, I mean, if you were to look into a situation today, if a child consumes that and is rushed immediately to the hospital, it is the emergency department that attends, not the specialist. And in the emergency department, as far as I've observed, there is never a specialist. You can go to any hospital. I mean, this is not complaint. It's just an observation. You know, it's very difficult to have specialists placed everywhere. But I think there is a very serious situation in the department, in the emergency department, because it's all very well to have, you know, big signs put up, Kachimasan and things like that. But how many patients are actually being saved? And if you were to put a camera in, I think there's a lot of confusion that is going on. So coming back to the question of lavage, would you have a specialist doctor there who is ready to perform a lavage? And as far as I know, based on the scouring that I did on the internet, lavage is totally an unacceptable procedure today.
Your thoughts? Okay.
Thank you, sir. Firstly, you do not need a specialist. It's just putting in a Rowell's tube, a feeding tube into the stomach, and aspirating any medication that may still be in the stomach at that time. Lavage is not the answer to all poisons. In fact, if you were to read a lot of the poison bottles, it will say, do not do lavage. Okay. In such cases, it is because, one, the so-called poison may not be harmful to the child, or secondly, because absorption rate is high and it would have entered the bloodstream by then. So doing a gastric washout is not the be-all and end-all to cases of poisoning. In such cases, by the time, and realistically speaking, especially in KL, even if you were to live next to a hospital, by the time you get to the emergency department, I think a significant amount may have already been absorbed into the system. In these cases, the child will be admitted and observed. In certain drugs like paracetamol, the drug levels will be monitored at a regular interval, and other steps will be taken. These are the common drugs that you do, that you actually monitor, and that children actually accidentally consume. Secondly, medical officers are the ones who usually do gastric washouts, not the specialists in the hospital setting, and they're trained to do it. If they're unsure and they know what drug was consumed, they would contact the specialist to get further advice, or in cases where we're not quite sure about what to do with the poison, either we look up the internet or we call the poison center.
Ah, speaking of the internet, what do you do with parents who come in knowing everything?
I entertain them because I respect really? Their resourcefulness in looking up the internet, and then we can go over the concerns that they have. If they brought along the, last time we used to print out, now they bring the phone, and then we can actually discuss each point so that if something that they discovered on the internet is not true, I will try to set the record straight and provide evidence on my part to say why I'm right and the internet article was wrong. If whatever they have read is correct, then I'll say, well done, you know, you've done your research. And this is especially relevant in children with heart disease because a lot of parents will Google.
Any other question? Yes, go ahead.
A quick question or even a comment. Sugar is poison. Please comment.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Sugar is a form of carbohydrate, and carbohydrates are essential to our lives because that's where we derive our energy from. However, if you just take pure sugar, then it is easily absorbed. You get a rapid rush of sugar levels, which then again rapidly declines, and it is not the healthiest way to take carbohydrates. It is better if you take complex sugars or complex carbohydrates, which results in a more sustained and prolonged blood sugar level.
I think that applies to us as well, isn't it? Not just the kids?
Water is a poison. Anything that is consumed beyond the level,
not in moderation, in excess,
is bad for our body. So sugar is good for energy. We need sugar to grow. Children need sugar to run around for their metabolic need. So reasonable amount of sugar is okay, but not excessive. Just like drinking water, too much water is equally bad.
Of course. Yeah. Question?
I have a 23-month-old who actually stopped eating for about 3 months all of a sudden. So suddenly he doesn't want blended or semi-blended or even normal food, the food we eat. He has just lost interest in food. I've taken to 3 pediatricians with different views. One says, try to force him to eat before he forgets what's eating. One says, just pump him with milk. And another says, just do a balance of both. Try to remind and try to give milk. My son was actually breastfed until 16 months. So after that, he just refuses any type of formula. So for him, if he sees anything, milk is as if I'm cheating him. So he opted for water. So even now, when he's hungry, he will find for water. So if the pediatrician suggests to give appetizers, he gets hungry, he finds for water. So I only could give him milk during the nights when he's like some sort of a dream feed to sustain him during the day. So it makes me wonder, is it a common scenario for the terrible two stage where they just want to play and not eat? Or should I just be happy just that he consumes a little milk? He has not lost weight, still maintaining and just at the border.
Can I assume he has no medical problem? He's perfectly healthy?
He's eczema baby.
Right. And he has no illnesses recently that triggered a bad... Again, we have to go back to the dietary history. Normally, we have to sit down and talk to the parents. Impossible for a child to be alive until now and eat nothing except water. So we have to go through what actually goes through the day from the morning until evening. And you don't have to drink milk per se because you can substitute the calorie from a milk nutrition from other form of dairy products such as cheese or yogurt or, and so on. And of course, if the child is to the extreme of not eating anything, I think we need to come in to do a full assessment.
Having Dr. said Yong? That, food strikes are very common. What you cook today, you mean, mom, you're the best mom in the world. I love your cooking. You serve that again 3 days later. Ew, I hate this food. I have never liked it. Nothing beats a child to actually deflate your ego in the kitchen. What you can do is try to present it in different ways. Maybe he likes the color. Maybe he likes the texture. And what I would do is ignore for a bit while you eat with your husband and make sure your husband praises your cooking. But not often. Children, when they find that you don't ask them to eat, that's when they want. Forbidden fruit is always the sweetest. If you don't give it to them, they'll be curious. Why is mommy and daddy eating and not offering any to me?
That's quite common because I think that's the only little food that goes in is what's on my plate. Yes. So when he comes around and takes that few grains, so he's literally sustaining on that little
few grains. It's reverse psychology.
You maximize those grains. Push out the calories in each mouthful.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're running out of time. I just wanted to give you this bit of information. If you need more support from a medical team when it comes to your child, if they have, you know, feeding difficulties and stuff, you can log on to what we call the Identification and Management of Feeding Difficulties website. It's just www.imfed.my, and both Dr. Chiang and Dr. Yong are on the panel there. So log on and you will find out more. Thank you both, Dr. Yong, Janina Fadzil, and Dr. Chiang Hon Kit. Thank you.
This is an edited recording of the panel discussion that was held at the BFM Health and Living Junior event on November 13th. BFM Health and Living Junior is presented by Nippon Paint, the coating expert.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.